Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking to review most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. My only guest today is Jody Dean, author of The Communist Horizon, just out from Verso. Before that, a few words in the news, actually from a rather long-term perspective today. On Tuesday, the Federal Reserve's policymaking group, the Federal Open Market Committee, announced the results of its latest meeting. They have them every 6 weeks or so. The bottom line was that they anticipate that the policy they characterize as exceptionally low interest rates will continue through at least mid-2015. There are several remarkable things about this declaration. One is that they're declaring it openly at all. Time was, the Fed was very secretive about these deliberations, and highly paid Wall Street analysts would try to decipher their policy intentions from the central bank's day-to-day operations. Now the Fed issues press releases at the conclusion of every meeting. No one should ever believe that these releases are thoroughly truthful or complete, but judging from the transcripts of their meetings, which are released 5 years after the fact, they do spend some time laboring over the wording to convey exactly what they want to convey. So that same set of highly paid analysts now parses the releases with the care of a new critic closely reading a John Donne poem. These days, though, subtlety is out of fashion, as the Fed wants everyone in the financial markets to know that they're serious about keeping rates low for a very long time. The hope is that this will encourage lending and spending. Which leads me to another remarkable thing, the Fed's devotion to economic stimulus. People who grew up on William Grider-style populism, which sees the Fed as nothing but a force of austerity, did not appreciate how today's Federal Reserve has little in common with Paul Volcker's of the late 1980s, which was intent on breaking inflation, which meant breaking labor. The U.S. Federal Reserve is about the only powerful institution in the economic world today pressing for stimulus, when austerity is all the rage. Its chair, lifelong Republican Ben Bernanke, gives speeches about the misery and damage of long-term unemployment. Who else in public life talks like that? But now a longer-term point. One reason the Fed can be so stimulative is that labor is flat on its back. Transcripts of policymakers' deliberations over the decades reveal an institution that's deeply sensitive to the state of the class struggle. Not, of course, that they'd call it that. For example, the unemployment rate is one of three major indicators that the Fed regularly releases forecasts on, along with consumer price inflation and GDP growth, meaning that unemployment figures very heavily in their thinking. The unemployment rate is a measure of labor market slack. When it's high, workers have no bargaining power. When it's low, they get some leverage. The current unemployment rate says there's plenty of labor market slack, and the degree of slackness is even higher than the rate suggests because of vast labor force withdrawal. In a series of papers published in the 1990s, the economist Edwin Dickens reviewed the evidence provided by Fed transcripts from the 1950s through the 1970s to demonstrate just how central the state of the labor market has been to policy deliberations. Looking at these is a reminder of how much has changed in the labor market landscape over the last 30 years. In the old days, strikes happened and unions mattered. But the emphasis on the state of the labor market in an institution with deep historical memory is important, even at a time when labor unions are rapidly fading in both density and power. Back in the 1950s, the Fed deliberated extensively over the drama of contract negotiations, particularly in the all-important auto and steel industries. The Fed would have to set an example, said one Fed governor in a 1956 meeting. The system's action should be decisive enough to cause businessmen to realize the danger of a wage-price spiral and not abdicate when they face wage negotiations, in the way they would if they felt they could simply increase their prices and continue to sell goods. Another member at the same meeting, some definite action on the part of the system would strengthen the hands of industry in wage negotiations coming up. When the recession came the next year, 1957, the Fed welcomed it, and continued to tighten in an effort to prevent a premature recovery and with it a return of wage pressures. They did not want to foster, in the words of one policymaker, the illusion on either side in wage negotiations as to the possibility of wage increases being passed on as price increases. The discourse was similar more than a decade later in transcripts from 1969 and 1970, when inflation was becoming a more serious chronic problem. There was much worry about labor negotiations, particularly in auto, because even if productivity improvements could pay for any wage increases in a new contract, the auto settlements might have significant psychological influences on the direction of inflation, one policymaker said. Several members mentioned that the Fed might have to provoke a recession to make a serious dent in the problem of inflation. Union negotiations haven't counted for much in the last decade or two, but that doesn't mean the state of the labor market has been demoted as an object of study among the policymakers. For example, the booming labor market of the late 1990s inspired lots of discussion of when just right became too tight. For example, the transcript of a meeting in the summer of 1998, when the unemployment rate was at its lowest level since 1970, shows detailed attention to statistical and anecdotal reports on the situation. At one point, presidents of the Fed's regional branches engaged in a bit of can-you-top-this competition in recounting tales of worker shortages and wage pressures. Atlanta brought the story of a high-tech firm that had leased a BMW for every one of its 40 employees. In Minneapolis, workers are making demands over quality-of-life issues like more flexible hours and relaxed dress code. There was a lot of concern about high rates of turnover. Why stick around if it's easy to get another job? Another worry, cited by another regional president, indicators of worker insecurity have appeared to turn towards increasing security. That's a bad thing. But unions hadn't disappeared from view. There was extensive discussion of the ongoing strike at GM, which went as far as analyzing the internal politics of the United Auto Workers. Along with the GM situation, they discussed labor troubles at Bell South and Lucent, and competition for workers that were leading to wage and benefit increases. The tautness of the labor market wasn't only discussed in the Fed's private deliberations. Greenspan also worried aloud about the state of the labor market in public. In congressional testimony in 1999, for example, he noted further tightening of the labor markets, a dwindling in the pool of available workers, which was leading to potentially inflationary wage pressures. These pressures were partly offset by productivity gains, as well as another factor, fear. Quoting Greenspan, "A residual fear of job skill obsolescence, which has induced a preference for job security over wage gains, probably is still holding down wage levels." But continuing tightening of the labor markets would lead to further inflationary pressures, Greenspan worried, that would require the Fed to act preemptively ahead of a pickup in reported inflation. Now we're a long way from all that, practically the mirror image, in fact. The right hates Bernanke and the Fed's regime of indulgence because they fear inflation. Romney's promised to replace him with someone more hawkish. But the chances of inflation with the labor market this week and wage increases non-existent are immeasurably small. You don't need a Marxist to tell you that monetary policy is all about the balance of class forces. Just read the Fed's own documents. Let's take a musical break. That was some of Beethoven's marvelous piano trio No. 7, The Archduke, performed by Daniel Barenboim, Pinchas Zukerman, and Jacqueline Dupre. My guest today is Jody Dean. Jody teaches politics at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York, and is an amazingly prolific writer of books. I think she's up to 11. I had her on the show a couple of years ago to discuss blog theory, her examination of how internet communication is deeply wrapped up with a death drive. Her latest is The Communist Horizon, just out from Verso as part of their Pocket Communism series. I've long been afflicted with what Jody, following Wendy Brown, calls left melancholy. I've lamented the difficulty of articulating a coherent alternative to this brutal society, a more peaceful and egalitarian way of organizing life, and despaired of even imagining how we might get there. Jody Dean is an energizing alternative to that passivity and gloom. Many listeners might not like what she has to say about utopian ambitions, she's for them, and democracy. She's not so for that. But it's still all well worth listening to. Jody Dean. Welcome, Jody. First of all, communism. As was proven on the Twitter last night, a lot of people have trouble with that word. Certainly, I'm sure you're used to it. Why do you embrace that word so prominently?
Communism is the one word that signifies anti-capitalism at its core. The right knows this, and they call Obama a communist. He's obviously not a communist. They call Nancy Pelosi a communist. Everything that the right doesn't like is communist. And they say that because they recognize the power of the word. And I think that we need to claim that powerful word in anti-capitalist struggle.
What does it mean to you? What is the communist horizon?
Communism means to me the great adage from Marx, from each according to ability to each according to need. That's the kind of motivating principle or motivating underlying aspiration and purpose of communism. For the communist horizon, I mean, I think of the communist horizon as the politics that configures our setting. And I know that sounds kind of weirdly abstract, but the way I think about it is like if you're walking around outside, a horizon is the line that separates the earth from the sky, and it tells you where you are, right? So one of the ways that you get disoriented in the woods and the fog is you have no idea what, you know, where you're seeing because you can't see the horizon line. So sometimes we don't see it, but when we can see it, we can get our orientation of where we are from the horizon. And I think the communist horizon is the horizon that orients us where we are politically. Yeah, so if we think about the communist horizon historically, there's a Soviet experience that shaped us in the U.S., right? All of our history from the 20th century was in connection with the Soviet Union, our relation to the Soviet Union, our intense competition and rivalry with the Soviet Union, and also our period of being allies with the Soviet Union. So that part of our horizon is still there, right? That's still shaped where we are. And then, as I mentioned already, the way that the right is constantly saying all of this anti-communist stuff, that lets us know we're still within the communist horizon. And then, though, aspirationally, right, the kinds of ideals that that are present but maybe not fully articulated yet, maybe expressed in ways that that have been fearful of using the communist, the language of communism. So I think the communist horizon is a way of marking where we are politically in terms of the ideal of from each according to ability to each according to need.
Now, you don't have the same evaluation of the Soviet experience as a total failure that a lot of people on the left do, right?
Yeah. I don't think it's a total failure, right? I think there's stuff that we can learn from them, stuff that they did right. They did industrialize really quickly.
Oh, but of course, people say at a tremendous price of the gulag and
yeah, it's primitive accumulation in England and in Western Europe happened over a long period of time, and it was concentrated in the Soviet period. So the horrors, the deaths, the violence that took a couple of centuries were concentrated. I don't think it's surprising, right, that industrialization takes lives. So I think that, yeah, the Soviets did that. Yes, it was violent. The thing is I think that we can learn from that, okay, are there better ways to go about doing what we want to do economically? But also, we don't have to reindustrialize. So that it happened badly for them doesn't mean that communism per se is a bad idea, because we're already industrialized now.
I think a lot of people on the left these days would also criticize the scale of the Soviet thing. That, you know, it was a very large, ambitious industrial transformation. And whenever you get that kind of large ambition, you almost or inevitably get involved with gulags and repression. And we have to be modest and local and provisional in our desires and experiments.
Oh, God, you know, when someone says modest and local and provisional, I want to reach for my gun. But that's probably not good in the context of talking about gulags. But I think that we have shortchanged ourselves. I mean, isn't that, what's so weird, right, isn't that also a kind of neoliberal sort of argument of privatization, small business, make everything kind of small, personal, individualized. Neoliberalism does it as an ideology, right? Even as it spreads its vast financial networks everywhere. I don't think we should buy into the small ideology, the local ideology. I think it's just, it's a way to try to tell people, don't be bold, don't think big, don't think that you can combine into great big, large masses and make things happen. So I'm very skeptical rhetorically of the emphasis on local and provisional. But I also think that the things that are cool in the world also require lots of large-scale things, right? Like global travel, global transportation of goods, satellites, you know, weather analysis, the internet is global. The thing with the local stuff is it seems like it goes backwards, right? Rather than trying to say, okay, let's keep, let's keep building this interconnected world that we have and now make it one that's not just for the 1%. It says, oh, no, we can't do that. The only way we can go back is have little small gardens. That seems crazy.
Well, I think in turning away from Marxism, one of the things that's been lost on among radicals these days is the sense that capitalism has done some work for us.
Yeah, I think that's right.
That it laid the ground, the passage in the Manifesto, of course, which is famous evocation of the marvelous things that capital has done in some ways, like creating a world literature even.
Oh, that's right. That's a great one.
But I think a lot of people now want to turn completely against that, and that the problem is precisely the scale and scope that capitalism has created. You are, in some sense, recovering that old tradition of Marxism of wanting to build and not step back.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, that's the way I see it, as looking at looking at what capitalism has achieved and taking it, right? Not just totally demolishing it, but taking it and making it in the interest of the people, in the interest of the people who make and produce it, and not in the interest of the 1%. I think absolutely it's a continuation, seizing what we have, not totally smashing it up.
Yeah, there's a line from Patti Smith, which I gave to Michael Hart, which he then appropriated, which is, we created it, let's take it over.
Oh, I love that line. I'm going to be another appropriator of it.
I was speaking with Jody Dean, who's the author of The Communist Horizon, just out from Verso, an extremely attractive little volume in a series of very attractive little volumes that Verso is doing now. The Horizon, of course, as I remember my childhood, science is about 25 miles away, I think, but you never reach it. So is the Communist Horizon some kind of impossible goal that recedes as you move towards it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't mean it that way, though I worry that sometimes I lapse into that. What I mean it as a fundamental division that establishes where we are, right? And so the fundamental division is, I think, between communism and capitalism, or between the owners and the workers. So I don't want it to be this thing that you're always striving for, but can't quite get, in a sense that the goal is some kind of sort of transcendent other thing. The way I understand it is, like, this is the division that establishes where we are, and we work within this towards something better, knowing that it's the working toward that brings about the something better, but not in a final way. You know, some of the criticisms of Marxism, particularly the criticisms of utopianism, say that it posits communism as the end of politics, right? Once we reach communism, politics will be over. Well, that's wrong.
Foucault called it the dream of the end of history.
Yeah, that's good, yeah. Right? And I think when I'm talking about communism, I have that criticism in mind, and I'm trying to address that criticism by saying, no, it's not that politics are over at that standpoint, at that time, because communism would have to be something that we are always working out, always working on ourselves as a collective to accomplish and to make ourselves continue to do it. It's almost like a kind of even more slightly proceduralist or formal sense of communism, in the same way we think of democracy sort of formally and procedurally. Nobody ever says, okay, well, here's democracy, now we're all done, right? And the same thing would be the case for communism. It's not now that there's communism, now we're all done. Communism is the idea of we are ordering our collective production and distribution for our own good. And we'll have to continue to do that.
Democracy, yeah, that's not something I wanted to talk about. There's a guy in Clinton's National Security Council who said, democracy only works when there's fundamental agreement in the nature of property. So democracy just assumes away all the interesting questions about politics, right? That notion of democracy. But you are democracy is all the rage across the political spectrum these days. Many radicals, talking about radical democracy, right? What does democracy mean to you, and why are you not so much a fan?
Yeah, I think democracy is the name for the fact that the left gave up on communism. The left stopped thinking in terms of grand projects, grand ideals. The left became accommodationist and said, yeah, okay, capitalism is the only game in town. There is no alternative. And democracy is the form of our politics takes. And once we've been, once we've given up, I think that's wrong, right? I think it's just kind of fundamentally wrong. And I think we've seen the last 30 or 40 years what happens when the left gives up. When the left gives up, the rich get richer and the rest of the people get screwed. And that's what we have. That's what democracy looks like, right? Is the rich getting richer and the rest of the people getting screwed.
But I think the response from the Democrat, the fans of democracy would say that this is an incomplete democracy and that money pollutes it. And if we can just get money out of politics, democracy would be much better.
Okay, and so what does that mean to get money out of politics? I think that that's a kind of very sweet and nice language that is standing in for seizing the banks and redistributing the money to the people so that some folks are not entering the political process with over 50% of the collective goods. So if money out of politics means redistributing the wealth among poor and working people, then okay, I'd be in favor of that. But I think for the most part, it's much more kind of banal repeal Citizens United, which actually doesn't legally even make sense, right? Because you don't repeal a Supreme Court decision. So I don't think that the language of money out of politics makes a lot of sense because rich people will always have political influence.
The people are the subject of democracy, but also of communism in some sense.
Yeah.
Who are these people, in your view, of the communist horizon?
I talk in the book about the sovereignty of the people and argue that we should think about, that we should replace the important Marxist idea of the dictatorship of the proletariat with the idea of the sovereignty of the people. And I understand the people then as the, almost as, the radicalized peasants and workers of the present. So the people I think of as it's almost, you could see it as it's like the 99%. It's a divided group. But it's also not strictly empirical. It's much more of a name for the aspirations of working and oppressed people in the kind of good old communist tradition of being on the side of the oppressed in every struggle.
Now, but the people, half of these people are going to vote for Romney, and the other half are going to vote for Obama, who isn't that much better.
So the actually
existing people, it's hard to imagine them as the agent of this communist transformation.
Yeah, I don't think they're the agent of it. I think they would be the maybe the object of it.
They would be produced in the act of revolution.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds... here's the thing. I mean, honestly, it doesn't take all that many people to have a revolution. You can do it with probably 10% of the population. I mean, for the most part, we even know that democracy doesn't require everybody. None of our politics ever requires everybody. So I'm not so worried about the empirical disconnect between kind of real existing people and the idea of a communism mobilized in the name of the people as the working and oppressed folks under capitalism.
Now, I think a lot of liberals and radicals would hear that and hear authoritarianism, that they have a minority of the population that is presuming to speak on behalf of the majority and taking actions which the majority might not approve of. You're not looking for a plebiscite to lead the way to this transformation.
No, I think if we think about California, the plebiscitary democracy there has actually been very much in the interest of the wealthy classes and very much against the interest of even the middle classes, right, with the way that their tax laws have eviscerated their educational system, or with the way that their with the anti-gay marriage wide
Prop
scale,
eight.
Yeah, Prop 8.
Yeah.
I don't support a kind of plebiscitary approach, but I also the thing that really kills me with the kind of accusation of authoritarianism is why isn't it authoritarian when liberals talk this way? Like liberals only have one or two or three or some, they have a small portion of people who are the active agents politically. They just mask this by saying, oh, neutral procedures, everyone can do it, blah, blah, blah. But it's the same end result as the few active people are the ones who are actually pushing a politics or trying to rearrange a system in the terms of the politics that they support.
We're listening to an interview with Jody Dean, author of The Communist Horizon, just out from Verso. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Back with more of Jody Dean after a musical break. I'm going to grow my hair real long and smoke a ton of grass, stay up all night every night discussing race and class. How about some of Sleepyhead's communist love songs, an example of left melancholy from 1996. Now on to part two of my interview with Jody Dean, author of The Communist Horizon, just out from Verso. Let's talk some about left melancholy, which appeals to me as a concept because I think I suffer from it. What do you mean by it? What is it a symptom of?
I think left melancholy is a symptom of giving up on the ideals around communism. I think it's the symptom, I think it's what happens to leftists when we only think that we can pursue small local solutions within a democratic context. I mean, melancholy is what sets in when folks have kind of given up on the association of the party, given up on a big struggle that we can, that we can engage in and that we can perhaps see ourselves realizing. I mean, it's no wonder that people on the left become kind of cynical and melancholic. We've given up the option, we've given up the very politics that we need to enliven us as a left.
But how does this politics get called into being? And it's not something that intellectuals can create.
The cool thing, yeah, we don't have to create it, right? This is that's what's been so great about 2011. The world is creating these politics from Tahrir Square through the movements of the squares in Greece and Spain to Occupy Wall Street. Intellectuals are the ones kind of catching up to the already, to the sort of real existing movement of peoples. So I think that we don't have to try to invent something. I think the best thing that intellectuals can do is to try to provide language and arguments that can encourage and facilitate these exciting revolutionary energies.
Well, yeah, the Occupy thing certainly at least temporarily cured my melancholy. But here we are a bit over a year later.
Yeah.
And what verb tense does one use with it?
I've worried about that too. The verb tense, right? You use present or past. It's a hard one.
Is the thing still alive? I mean, Fran Piven has this very encouraging notion that the way movements work is they go in ebbs and flows, and so you have the example she points to is the civil rights movement, which people pronounced dead many times in the 50s and 60s, and then came back.
Right.
So that's the hopeful thing. This is just a series of waves, and the tide is out at the moment. Do you see this as a lingering presence in at least American politics?
I hope so. I mean, I think it's still alive now, and it's alive in different forms, alive through strike debt, alive through Occupy Education and many of the other working groups. I mean, it's really alive in in places outside New York, because everybody still wants to hear about Occupy. People want to know what's going on. Folks still believe in the movement in Occupy Wall Street and would like to see more happening. I think that what we need is something that's going to have the energy that was associated with the encampments, even though we know that it's really unlikely that something like the encampments will reemerge. We just haven't seen the new form yet.
I'm speaking with Jody Dean, who is the author of The Communist Horizon, just out from Verso. The Occupy movement does exhibit, perhaps saying suffer from would be too judgmental of me, some of the problems that you were talking about earlier, and you've talked about here and elsewhere in your writing. The devotion to the local, the provisional, the reluctance to articulate grand schemes of transformation. Do you see signs that it's getting beyond that and moving beyond the melancholy?
I think so. I think one of the things that's exciting to me about the strike debt campaign is that there's a real focus there, right? It's not just, oh, anything from, you know, ending the Fed, which was nuts, you know, very nutty part of some of the Occupy, from some Occupy activists. It's not kind of ending the Fed, you know, changing the campaign finance laws and having alternative banking, and ending foreclosures, right? It's not this great big amorphous pile of things. It's a very focused campaign that looks at the impact of debt, from municipal debt through personal debt for medical, mortgage or educational reasons, all the way through payday loans. So I think that there's something really good about strike debt that is addressing some of the problems of focus. Now, on questions of leadership and horizontality, that's not so clear to me yet how that's working out. I mean, it seems like, I mean, I would have thought that something with more something that was more of an organizational structure that would have groups that would say, okay, you know, you three people are responsible for this group, and you know, you guys can rotate or whatever, and then report to these other, basically, you know, report to another group, and a much more, a much firmer distribution of roles and responsibilities. I would have thought that that would have been a good thing to do, but it doesn't seem like the activists in New York really think that. And it's just, I wonder if it's a matter of time until they adopt a more rigid form, or if they are going to be able to make this super flexible form work for them. So I might be wrong on the formal organizational thing. I don't think so, but it could be. Maybe they'll make it work.
But I wonder if the combination of that organizational problem and the inability or unwillingness to articulate a grand ambition has something to do with our inability to come up with a proper verb tense. I mean, is this why the thing dissipated?
That seems like it. I mean, that's got to be part of it, right? It's got to be part of it that the inability to pull together an organization that would have duration, even as the energy of the movement would ebb and flow. I mean, that's the way it seems to me. I mean, I hope I'm wrong.
Now, you write about the party in the book. Does it have a capital P? I can't remember. And you hint that there's something about Occupy that's party-like, but it's not really what we would think of as a party that people who read their Lenin would think of as a party.
What I think was the party-like aspect of Occupy was the vanguardism. And in some ways, you know, horizontal types don't like using the language of vanguards. But for crying out loud, folks, you know, people who are willing to sleep in parks for political reasons, that's a vanguard, right? That's a really...
I'm not willing to sleep in a park, and I'm glad somebody is.
I am too, right? That's exactly right, right? That's what makes them the vanguard. Those are the folks who are willing to do something politically that the rest of us support in our behalf. And they did this all over the country and all over the world. So they're acting like a vanguard in the very best, most exciting way. It's leading the movement. It's inspiring the movement. It's providing loci for the movement around which to organize. So I think that these aspects of the encampments are really, really important. And so what we need to think about is, okay, this is going to seem strange, but a vanguard from the bottom up, right? And which I actually think is a Leninist vanguard as well. The vanguards had to come from somewhere.
But despite claims to the contrary, there were professional anarchist revolutionaries involved too. It wasn't just a bunch of amateurs spontaneously coming together.
Oh, you mean in Occupy?
Yeah,
but. I actually don't think professional or non-professional is the issue here, right? I mean, by professional, you mean paid anarchists?
No, I mean people who are really experienced and just didn't come to this out of nowhere. I mean,
oh, right.
They've been at this game a long time.
Right, a lot of the activists have been at this game for a long time.
Yeah.
But that's still, I think, I would still call that a bottom-up thing, right? Because it's not like there's sort of anarchist central, like sending out agents. It's much more that people with strong political commitments and experience were able to galvanize.
But there's this notion, I think, that somehow, and a wide variety of people hold this, I think, that somehow spontaneously the oppressed masses are going to rise and throw off their chains. you need some experienced and educated and sophisticated leadership to catalyze that, to make that happen. It just doesn't happen spontaneously.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's right. And I think that, basically, I think that we're agreeing with the disagreements in the language of top or bottom, probably. Mm. Because I think that these experienced, educated, politically aware and organized folks are, you know, exist in multiple places and have different networks with one another and are able sometimes to act in ways that can mobilize a lot of people. Not always, right? And part of the problem is how to take these super kind of organized and experienced folks and let their skills persist with more duration with other people around them, right? That's what seems to me to be the organizational problem. So again, not something that's coming from a kind of small group directing things, but much more from experienced people on the ground. How are they building and spreading? Yeah, how are they building and spreading their movement? And that sort of second description is how I understand the way a party works, right? The way that a communist party should work, and the way that the Leninist Party worked sometimes, right, with professional revolutionaries, with real skills, working with people on the ground and being part, you know, directly part of their struggles, their strikes, their lives, the distribution of basic, you know, sometimes the distribution of basic goods that they needed during strike time. So that's does that make sense?
Yeah, but I think the challenge, at least for somebody coming from my point of view, is to make those leaders accountable, but also give them some degree of authority. And I think there are a lot of folks around Occupy who, or, you know, like a lot of American anarchists who just like would say that's impossible, that once you get structures, you're going to get a leadership backing its own interests that's not accountable, that's authoritarian and ossified and rigid and all those terrible things. So your idea of the party, it has to have some kind of structure. It's just not...
Yes, that's exactly right. It does have to have a structure. I think, and I think we agree on this part, I think that the structure is what prevents them from being hyper-authoritarian. It makes them, it gives them authority without letting them be authoritarians. And I think that the anarchist non-structure actually is what creates this, these possibilities for sort of crazy, either doing nothing or being extremely dogmatic and kind of non-inclusive and dogmatic, non-inclusive, and unable to spread and persist. So I think organization is what can solve that problem.
Now, there were people around Occupy who thought that the occupations themselves were like the embryo of a new society, that, you know, they were living the future reality. I mean, do you think there's anything to that position?
I feel like in sort of solidarity with the work of occupiers, I should say yes, but I actually not so much, right? I don't think our basic problems are that we don't treat each other nicely. I don't think our basic problems are in our ways of relating to other people. I think our basic problems are a capitalist system.
Americans are a very brutal society in a lot of ways, but we do treat each other pretty nicely. We're polite to each other. We're friendly. I mean, even here in, you know, mean-ass New York City, we're pretty nice to each other. So, I mean, I don't buy that diagnosis at all.
Yeah, so I think that to the extent that sort of a new way of being is prefigured, I don't buy that. I do think, though, that did some young people who may not have been politically active before see themselves differently because of their participation in the movement? I would say yeah. And so it opened up a sense of, oh my God, I can do things. Oh my God, we can act collectively in ways that we couldn't before. That part of Occupy, I think, is sort of, you know, transformational, but with a very, very, very small t.
But it did allow at least for a temporary shedding of the melancholy.
Yeah, that's right.
And so
that's,
what was the mechanism of that? How did it demonstrate itself?
I would say in probably two interconnected ways. One, we all said we again, right? I mean, everybody on the left said we in ways that we had not said for 30 years. People thought of themselves as part of a collective with a political project, future, and commonality together. So I think that the that we shed melancholy because of this sense of way. And I also, and then related to that, we shed melancholy because we could imagine ourselves acting again. We could imagine ourselves acting collectively and making, I don't know, making politics happen sounds so banal, but I actually think it was that. So I think it was this kind of eventful aspect of Occupy Wall Street that let us shed the melancholy.
And in some sense, that was the people, or at least representatives of the people, defining themselves in practice. It was not some abstraction being called out of nowhere.
Yeah, that's right, right? It's the people creating themselves as an active people.
But not really knowing where they wanted to take it.
That's right.
And is that a good thing, a bad thing?
The beginning discussion with, when there were no demands, created a nice, exciting open space for people to have multiple possibilities. Then I think that became kind of stifling. And it was like, oh, it's so fun being together. All right, now what are we going to do? And when it became to the now what are we going to do part, then the arguing, rightly so, it's necessary, starts to happen. And then people get tired and go home or want to do something else. But I think that at that point, we didn't move from the excitement of being together to knowing where we wanted to go.
Now, the 99% thing was, in many ways, very inspiring because it did suggest a real, almost universality minus one. I remember Susie Bright once said to me that workers of the world unite is an erotic sentiment. I mean, there's this kind of creation of this very exciting collective that had not existed in, my memory as a grown-up, really, since, the 60s. But it was the notion of it being defined like 99%. In classical Marxism, it's the proletariat,
right,
which is the producer of value, which, works, and the bourgeoisie appropriates that value for its own ends and for its own increased wealth. So, but there is a, you can identify some kind of process, social process there, the exploitation, creation of value, and what creates the commonality among the proletariat is this common relation to value creation. Mm-hmm. The 99% is more like a demographic category. It doesn't have that kind of active definition. And whereas you envision the proletariat as the potentially revolutionary force because it creates the value and can withhold its labor and demand the transformation of it, of the whole process. Whereas the 99%, it's almost like something on the distribution table. It doesn't have that kind of active definition. I mean, is this a problem?
I'm going to say, I'm going to answer this in a couple of different ways. You're absolutely right about the 99% as a demographic category. If we put that in the perspective not of comparing it with the revolutionary proletariat, but compare it with the identity politics of the last 30 or 40 years, it's an improvement because it's not based in a substantial identity. It's not based in ethnicity or sexuality. And I think that's really good. It's a kind of collective identity that has no real substance. It's created as a demographic category. And kind of coolly, it's created out of the same sorts of statistics that capital presents itself in. So that's what I kind of really love that about the we are the 99%, right? It's like, oh, we know the enemy. The enemy is the 1% who is appropriating much more of the share of our commonwealth than it should.
And it really is a good, it's a different name for the big bourgeoisie. I mean,
that's exactly right.
That's the way I think of it.
No, me too.
But
right?
I'm old fashioned.
And I think that that's the power of it, right? It lets us say it gives more meat to Wall Street to Main Street by saying, look, Wall Street has 1%. Wall Street is just the 1%. Main Street's the 99%. Then how come they have more than half of the of the common good or the common surplus? So that's the first part. On the value part of the question, I was wondering what you might think of this. So in the book, I try to argue this in terms of my communicative capitalism idea. And there's it's a variation on the Hart and Negri account of the contemporary economy as one where communication has subsumed all forms of capitalist production.
Yeah, now, as I was reading that, I was thinking, vulgar empiricist that I am, GM still has four times the revenue of Google. I mean, so there's, the old world still exists.
Yeah, I know the old world still exists, but isn't it also the case that GM is still incorporated within, or has been influenced by, and in a way subsumed under some of these communicative, networked informational forms. And my basic idea is that that these days we could say pretty easily that 99% of the people produce communicative. We work communicatively. We have a kind of communicative labor. We might upload stuff all over the internet, even if it's just crazy comments, even if it's just our pictures. But our communicative interactions that are other drivers, or most important drivers. So I could think you might correct this. We produce these communicative acts that are drivers of the economy because we have an informational communicative economy. And these communicative acts are the social substance. Now, in Marx, the commodity is a form that is a crystallization of the social substance. So he understands value as it's in the commodity, as a crystallization of this larger social substance. I think that these days the social substance is exploited directly, and that's why the argument in the book using Google and PageRank, how Google's PageRank that monetizes directly relations among people. And so I think that perhaps because our basic social life can be exploited apart from the commodity relation, the 99% makes sense as a political category, because it's our communicative actions that are exploited.
Now, I think Marx said somewhere that the worker only feels himself when he's at home.
Yeah.
So, but it's as if the capitalist now is,
everywhere.
Tentacles are in the home life, too. And so these kinds of relations you're talking about, Facebook is like, part of the home life. It's where people think they're themselves, but it's through this very, very capitalized network.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's spread in, kind of completely through our social being. So the one thing that the model that I have doesn't do very well is say, well, how is this a revolutionary a revolutionary people, right? Because in your question or comment that began this part of the exchange, you were saying, well, the proletariat can withhold its labor, and that's one of the things that gives it a kind of political power vis-a-vis the bourgeoisie. And the problem of the present is we actually can't really withhold our communicative acts, our productive communications, and as a way to bring the system down. So it's got to be something else. And that part I don't know the answer to.
Well, it's not clear whether Facebook is going to be able to make any money on what they're doing.
I've been wondering if there would be a way to have the users buy Facebook. So if the shares are down, what are the shares down to, something like $29 or $15 a share?
It's down, I think, half or so for this original offering.
Okay, so what if there was, I wonder if there's some way to set up a Facebook fund. So if there's 500 million users or something, so each person can buy one or two shares, and that we then own Facebook and buy it all up. Is that possible?
Yeah. I mean, their revenues are something like, in the U.S., are $3 per user per year. So there's not an enormous amount of cash coming into Facebook now. I mean, if we could all come up with $3, we could buy Facebook.
It would seem to be cool. I mean, there's got to be a way to set up something like, just call it the Facebook, users union, and set it up as a little monetary entity that would buy, because I guess not everyone can buy a stock, right? You have to go through a broker, but that would work with whatever.
You can do it directly, too.
Really? So each individual could individually buy a single stock?
Salon went public through some kind of web offering. The software exists. A friend of mine wrote it.
Oh, cool. See, I think that we have to take Facebook to the people by having each user. But I actually like to form it as a kind of Facebook collective.
Now,
sorry, of course, because it's off topic.
But now I'm going to bring it back on topic. Because I think a lot of people, say that Facebook is a distraction from the real things in life, the things that really matter. And it's just a big capitalist trick. But on the other hand, it does create global networks of people who now know each other in some way that's more than trivial.
Yeah.
Even though it's, it's not what we think of as old social ties, face-to-face ties, but it is, it does create. There are a billion people on Facebook now. I mean, that's like 1/7 of the world's population. What does that mean for politics?
I think it means that we can imagine, basically, we can imagine a communist international in ways that were
You've been very critical of this whole, you know, like press the like button culture and, you know, collectivism
yeah.
and all that.
I mean, I'm really critical of approach to politics that says that, you know, media is what we need to focus on, that that if you really want to do a political action, then make a blog or something like this. I think all of this is ridiculous. I think it's a form of the capture of our best and most aspirational energies into networks that benefit capital. So, you know, with that kind of very critical set of suppositions, I also think at the same time we can experience ourselves in global networks in ways that we haven't before. And what we've got to figure out is, so how do these become kind of, you know, use old language, in and for themselves, right? How do they become in and for themselves and not in and not simply for the interests of capital? Capital wants us to approach them individualistically. Right, so it's your opinion, your liking, your tweeting, your whatever. It's all very individualistically. What we've got to figure out is, how does this become much more of a much more collective, much more of a kind of common understanding, not simply an aggregation of individualized ones.
Which is, of course, the Communist Horizon.
Yeah, exactly.
That was Jody Dean, author of The Communist Horizon, just out from Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Here's some closing music from John Cale, Look Horizon. Till next week, bye.